This is October 15th, 2017, and the first of three Teisho Sundays in a row in the run-up to our Jukai ceremony, taking the precept ceremony that is in the last Saturday of November. In November, two of our Sundays are impacted by Sesshin, and the third one is our ceremony of gratitude, our annual ceremony of gratitude. So these next three will be it until the day of Jukai, and I'll do one that morning too. So in meditating on this series of Teishos, it occurred to me that not only is it the taking of the precepts coming up in this great Jukai, which is every 3 years, we have a little more elaborate ceremony of taking the precepts, but also we just started a term intensive. For anyone who may not know, a term intensive is a very popular program we have a couple times a year, and it's a chance for people for a limited time, just a few weeks, to step up their sitting, to do more sitting, and anything else that they feel could help them in the way of discipline, getting back on track, getting more aligned with their aspirations. So we just started one last Thursday. And what do these two have, the term intensive and the precepts? What they have in common is both we're dealing with habit energy. And in recent years, I've come to see that this is really what practice is all about. Our the habits, not just simple physical discrete habits like smoking or drinking or things like that, but the mental force of habit, that which keeps pulling the mind away from just the absolute simplicity of this moment, just this. Habit energy is one way to talk about it. Another is our tendencies, our deep-seated tendencies. And some of these we have in common, our tendencies toward greed in its many forms, even very light forms of grasping or craving, anger or hostility, ill will, and delusion. We call the three poisons, greed, anger, and delusion, in their many forms. And then other things, other this kinds of habit energy, we have, any one of us might have more than most people, and vice versa. We may not be troubled, we may not be afflicted by certain kinds of forms of habit energy as much as other people. So part of practice is seeing, having revealed for us what our particular issues are, to use a very popular word, what our issues are, what we keep running up against, our obstructions, our patterns, our propensities, our dispositions. These all refer to what in Buddhism is called the samskaras. These are forces that have acquired their force through repetition. Things we have done over and over and over. And so another very Buddhist word for this is karma. Our karmic tendencies, our karmic vulnerabilities. the word karma, in its simplest understanding, is just action. It just means action and reaction, or any kind of doing, any kind of intentional or volitional action. And that covers not just physical actions, but words, speech, and thoughts. In the repentance verse that we do in the Jukai ceremony, there's this phrase, all harmful actions committed by me since time immemorial, stemming from greed, anger, and delusion, arising from body, speech, and mind. Body, speech, and mind. But we can just, for the sake of simplicity and not repeating those three too often, really, when we talk about action or karma, it means all three. And our habitual actions and reactions, maybe reactions is even more more obvious of what we're up against, our habitual ways of reacting to people, to stress, to the unknown, situations of unfamiliarity, our habitual ways of reacting to those things and people is the challenge that we face in practice and training. In the term intensive, people who participate pledge to increase their sitting, their daily sitting, or the amount of sitting they do in the week as much as they may want to. The danger with term intensive is people overreaching, trying to rebuild Rome in a day, trying to go from a kind of a lackluster daily practice to something heroic. It's not wise to overshoot, because then if or when one fails to fulfill the amount of sitting one is pledged to do in a day or a week, then one can feel discouraged or feel like a failure. So this is the work of practice, the work of change. I don't think anyone undertakes any kind of practice without wanting to change or develop. So whether it's Zen practice or another kind of meditation practice or yoga, Qigong or Tai Chi, any kind of athletic practice, it's all, or diet, it's all effort to change, of course. Now, change isn't the whole of it, as we know in Buddhism, that there's what is often called this twofold truth. That it's like two sides of a coin. On the one side is this realm of change where we can improve, develop ourselves, strengthen ourselves. And then that's just half of it, though. The other half is this realm of no change, which really means, in practical terms, means there's nothing we need to change. That we are, from the very beginning, all Buddhas. All enlightened, all whole and complete. There's nowhere to progress to. And we also can't regress. There's no higher or lower. There's no success or failure. No better or worse. No stronger or weaker. No more pure or less pure. each one of us embodies the Buddha. Buddha, this meaning our Buddha nature, our enlightened nature. We are already there. There's nowhere to go. But that's just half the truth. So from that side, we can forget about doing anything. But from the other side, we can work on ourselves in order to be able to better help others, ultimately. That's Mahayana Buddhism. Zen is not just to try to achieve some kind of personal best or proficiency or mastery, but to purify our minds and our hearts and our characters in order to be able to serve others, to help others, and there's so many who are suffering. So we're going to focus on this change side of the coin, the ways in which we need to change for our own sake and for others' sake, and how we do that. The precepts that will be taken in that ceremony in late November are just a way of sketching out or describing what we are capable of ultimately. It's what the ways in which we can find ourselves in harmony with the way, the Tao, which means our own nature, ultimately, our own nature. But along the way toward coming into accord with the way, the Tao, we run into all kinds of things. We run into karma, the effect of previous causes we've set into motion. A little bit more about karma. First, just one reference to a koan. The koan that most directly, explicitly deals with causation, it's another word for karma, is causation, the law of cause and effect, is the one in the Mumonkan, Hyakujo and a Fox. Very briefly, this is where the abbot of a temple. It's a story. It's a kind of a myth, but it has a lot of truth to it nonetheless. An abbot is asked by someone, "Does the enlightened man still fall under the chain of cause and effect?" And this abbot said, "No, he does not," which is just half the truth. Which means it's not the truth. Anytime we say just half, we risk speaking just an untruth. So he said, no. In other words, to put this more loosely, no. Once you become enlightened, then the law of cause and effect is, you're free of it. Now that is ridiculous, because that would suggest that once you're enlightened, if you cut your finger, it won't bleed. Everything is cause and effect. Every one of us is, in a sense, determined by cause and effect. So that was because of that wrong answer. No, he's not bound by the law of cause and effect. This abbot was reborn into 500 years as a fox. Mm-hmm. That's the story. Who am I to say it's not true? But anyway, that's the story. And then And then this fox man finds his way to this great Chinese master, Hyakujo, and he wants to be released from this fox body because it's only through the human body that we can come to awakening. So he tells the story to Hyakujo, and he says, Now, you, please tell me, does the enlightened person still fall under the chain of cause and effect? And Hyakujo didn't say no, like that other abbot had said, and he didn't say yes. He said, he does not ignore the law of causation. Another translation is, he does not evade the law of causation. Or he doesn't deny the law of causation. This is a what Zen is called a turning word, meaning what it brought this fox abbot. It's hard to picture a fox abbot. It brought this fox abbot to enlightenment. Then it was a turning word. It turned his mind into enlightenment. Now, I'm going to turn to Roshi Kaplow's first book about death and dying and karma and rebirth, called The Wheel of Death, and read a passage here in which Yasutani Roshi, that was Roshi Kaplow's teacher, talks about this koan with the fox. He says, the fox here implies the power of our true nature. In other words, the power of the universe. The principles of Buddhism are an explanation of this power, and Zen practice is grasping this dynamic power and taking it into our life and personality. If you grasp the fact that being subject to the law of causation and freedom from it are one, it's truly simple. But if you analyze them, you become separate and false, and no matter how hard you reason about it, a trace of contradiction always remains. Now here is what I'm leading up to. He says, every existence is a momentary form appearing according to prevailing conditions, without a fixed form of its own. This is the teaching of no self. That there's no permanent self of any substance anywhere. That each one of us is energy in flux. We don't appear to be. People seem to be pretty solid and pretty much the same from year to year. And yet, the truth is that we are these what we call the self, this mental physical complex is really just a certain kind of congealed energy. And even this we could call karma. This is the effect of previous causes. But in Yasutani Roshi's words, every existence, and it's not just people, it's tables and cars, every existence is a momentary form appearing. That's the key word, appearing. This is the world of appearances, according to prevailing conditions, without a fixed form of its own. This absence of a fixed form is freedom from the law of causation. Having a form which accords with the conditions of the moment is subjection to the law of causation. Therefore, the very subjection to the law of causation is tantamount to our freedom from it. So each one of us is this integration of form and emptiness. The emptiness side is the flux change side, is means that we're not stuck with any personhood, and which means not stuck with any absolutely fixed karma. And at the same time, we are determined by cause and effect. If we cut our finger, it bleeds. Then it goes on and just uses another analogy, a moving picture, a film, as you know, appears according to the conditions of the film, light, and screen. The picture itself has no specific form of its own, so it's just an image flickering on the screen. Having no form of its own, it changes according to the movement of the film. This can be called subjection to the law of causation. At the same time, having no form of its own is its freedom or emptiness aspect. And so Mumon, the compiler of the Mumonkan, says, for the truly enlightened person, subjection to the law of cause and effect and freedom from it are one truth. And that's places us exactly where we all are, which is working, finding ourselves determined to some degree by our karma, everything, all the ways we've acted and reacted in the past, throughout this whole life and previous lifetimes. We have that we're up against. That's what is pushing us in a certain direction. But at the same time, of course, we have this freedom to choose. So in the simple act of doing zazen, sitting, we face this moment by moment where we see our thought habit forces pulling us. We get pulled into thoughts. We all know this over and over again. We get pulled into thoughts. Often they're the same kind of thoughts, but not necessarily. We get pulled into our thoughts. That's the force of karma. And then we can choose, when we notice those thoughts, we can choose whether to go on dwelling in those thoughts or emotions or feelings, same thing, or to return our attention to the practice of working on the breath. The breath is not a thought. Breathing is not a thought. Breathing is not an emotion. Breathing is not a feeling. It's just simple, direct experience. And that is how we change, by returning our attention again and again to that realm that is really beyond our karmic habits. So in all things, there, in terms of karma causation, there is the primary cause, and then secondary or contributing causes. And the most a very common example is that of a plant. The primary cause is the seed, and then the secondary causes are the right kind of soil, the right amount of sun, and the right amount of water. And this also applies to us human beings. I used to think of karma, I think many people do, who haven't been exposed to it and practicing for a long time, more as being punished for our misdeeds. But this, I think, is very misleading. A much better way of understanding it, I think, is that it's like there's a certain fundamental harmony or balance to reality. And when we violate the precepts, you know, when we kill or steal or misuse sexuality or lie or abuse alcohol or drugs or speak of the faults of others or praise ourselves and disparage others or indulge in anger or withhold spiritual material aid, when we do those things, then we are creating an imbalance that will be restored. It will have to be corrected. I think this is a much better way to understand the law of causation. It's not, there's nobody up there who's rendering judgment on us. It's not punishment. It's just a correction, a correcting of an imbalance. And then I found last night, I pulled a book off my shelves, which I'd never opened. Most of the books on my shelves I've never opened. Confession time. Though there are a lot of books there, in my defense. And I found this one called Karma, The Universal Law of Harmony. And it's an anthology edited by Virginia Hansen and a Rosemary Stewart. It's a it's based on theosophy. Theosophy, I had to look up. It's sort of a Buddhist, Hindu thing, belief system that, according to the dictionary, proposes to establish direct contact with divine principle through contemplation or revelation. Doesn't help me much to read that kind of definition, but it's it has elements of Buddhism in it, rebirth, reincarnation, and by the way, I meant to say, karma. The teaching of cause and effect, the doctrine of cause and effect, is really linked to rebirth. You really, karma, causation doesn't make any sense when you consider it only from within the span of time of one lifetime. Because we know that people can get away with murder. People who, you know, we see in the headlines can do terrible things, more likely the people we don't see in the headlines, the ones who get away with things, I think of financial crimes, and we don't see any retribution. But that's not important that we don't see it in this lifetime. According to the law of causation, anything like that where you are violating the Dharma, the law of harmony, will result eventually in some kind of correction, and the person will have to reap what he sowed. But I'm going to read from this one essay here. It's called, there are about, 10 or 12 essays in here, and this one is called The Rhythmic Return to Equilibrium. By James Perkins, and it just really clicked for me, and so I'm hoping that it will for some others of you. He starts out by saying, in ancient Egypt, artists created statues and paintings of the gods with the intent that the gods should enter and reside in their creations. And so works of art became sacred objects. And that means that they, I'm paraphrasing here, that those works of art had to be representations of unity and balance and proportion and rhythm and harmony, universal principles. These eternals, he says, are observed to be actively present in nature and were known to philosophers and high priests as composing the very foundations of universal order. That's another word, order. And that is how we can understand the law of causation. It's just the movement toward restoring order. Whenever we violate one of the precepts, we set up a situation where it's out of order, and order has to be corrected, will be corrected sooner or later. That's cause and effect, irrespective of the time. We don't know anything about the time. More on this principle of balance. He says, this principle of balance acts eternally and everywhere to return the cycles of action in worlds of matter, as well as of emotions, mind, and spirit, to an equilibrium of universal harmony. Karma neither rewards nor punishes. It is a law that brings every action to its right adjustment, a law that can be used beneficially in all of life's situations. But through human ignorance, it is a law that more often than not operates to cause suffering, sorrow, and destruction. He continues, divorced from the element of superstition, karma may be more truly conceived in a modern terminology as the feedback system of the functioning universe. It automatically rectifies inefficient or disharmonious use of the machinery of existence. Humans are self-generators of innumerable thought patterns, there it is again, habit forces, and desire impulses, followed by physical acts, each of which becomes a circuit of forces that can be closed only by the reaction that has been generated. We write our own tickets to glory and gloom. Usually our thinking centers mistakenly upon the idea that if we can close the door against threatened adversity or open some promising window of opportunity, all main problems will disappear. Yet the karmic mice materialize out of the very walls to harass us with fresh concerns. And then he talks about what he calls the eternal attraction toward attainment of perfection. And this made me think of our Buddha seed, as we say it in the one of the three refuges, three jewels. We refer to the Buddha seed, that, and I would see this as the aspiration toward self-realization, toward enlightenment. This it's like the seed of it's like an acorn that has within it this potential to become an oak tree, or like the stone of a peach stone to become a peach tree. Each one of us has within us this Buddha nature or Buddha seed to realize ourselves through full enlightenment. Those are Buddhist terms, and this go back to his own words. This will to perfection is imperative in evolution, having been ceaselessly active throughout the universe from the beginning. It provides the orientation that guides nature in the slow evolution of all forms and species toward their fulfillment. In man's consciousness, too, this principle is ever operative. The instinct to progress to a better state of affairs or a more ideal situation is more than a human hope. It is an urge rooted in the primeval purpose of life. It may be inactive at times, but is constantly present and ready when stimulated to awaken fresh motivation. like a term intensive, we see man, despite all frustration and denial, ever responding to newborn purpose, a new day, a new age, with new hope eternally springing in his breast, all of which testifies to an obligatory impellent latent in him, as well as in every other living thing, to achieve the perfect state. And just other words for this Buddha seed. And then a little bit more. The law of karma brings all cyclic action back to equilibrium, but how we behave in this action, what we do creatively with love to render it harmonious, is the supreme value in the experience. Harmony is as a divine chariot drawn by the horses of balance and all the other principles. Viewed similarly, perhaps one might think of harmony as the supreme law in the universe. And that also, that word harmony appears in the Three Refuges. I take refuge in Sangha and in its wisdom, example, and never-failing help, and resolve to live in harmony with all sentient beings. So is that there is this fundamental purity or order in our nature. That's our Buddha nature, our true nature. And then we can either act in accordance with it or not. And if we don't, then there are consequences that we have to deal with. Anyone who truly bought into, really accepted the law of causation, would never violate any precept. But for most people, we have to go through a lot of pain before we can really start to fully accept this law of causation. To be fair, karma is a conceptual system, a lot of doctrine of karma. But so are the precepts. The precepts are words and concepts. And both can be considered a kind of scaffolding that we can use to help us refrain from causing more painful karma. They're useful. They're practical. In order to navigate our way through a lot of potentially challenging, stressful situations. But even karma is a system, causation is a system that can help us if we believe in it. So some of the most recently we've been subjected to some of the most flagrant, horrifying examples of karmic dispositions, karmic energy. I think of Harvey Weinstein. It's this Hollywood mogul who turns out appears. I wasn't there in any of the incidents, but appears he's abused women for decades. And this we see how karma builds. So every time we speak or think or do something that is out of harmony with the way, it's wearing a deeper and deeper groove or a stronger and stronger habit force behind it. And it seems that he became consumed by this habit force, as did former Congressman Anthony Weiner, where they were unable to wrench themselves out of these forces, these afflictions. But more and more related to our own efforts and challenges here in following the path, what are the big things that we undertake to do in term intensive? Well, the main thing I hope that everyone includes in their pledge, their commitment in the term intensive, is to increase sitting. Why? Because everything follows from that. That is the, it's not just another activity, another way of trying to improve oneself. It is the way to facilitate all our other efforts at self-improvement. So it starts with sitting, and then exercise is something that many people, establishing some kind of regimen of exercise, either flexibility training or strength training or cardiovascular training, and establishing a better regimen of eating less or eating better. And these all are ways of undoing the pain-producing doing that has become a habit for us. So is overdoing, overscheduling. This is, I hear about this all the time, and I know it from myself, is trying to cram too much into any particular day or week. And this is another form of being out of balance. And how do we restore balance? It starts with sitting. But not just sitting. It's whatever we're doing, whatever we happen to be doing, driving or cooking or walking, showering, playing, to as much as possible to do it without thoughts sticking in the mind. Do it with our whole being, which is the opposite of how most people go through their lives. Most people, whatever they're doing, their mind is somewhere else. That's the problem, a split. But we have the possibility through practice, daily practice, of more and more overcoming this split and having our actions, our attention integrated into what is right in front of us. Any kind of addictive behaviors is another way to understand life out of balance. And addictive behaviors, more and more I see, is including cell phone use. People I see becoming so possessed by this device, taking them away from a full life of awareness and attention in the moment, being unable to resist, fleeing into their cell phone world all the time, fleeing from this, the moment, this living reality, into their screen life. So, all of this, everything I've just said, we don't really need to remember it or think about it. It was said in hopes that it would clarify why we do what we do, why we do this practice, as a way to purify ourselves of these habit forces that possess us. So our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. Beings without number,
I bow to the great endless blind passions. I bow to our root, dark gates. one measure, I bow to penetrate the wicked way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to break endless life passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain.